Good morning, Brother John.
Good morning, Jerry.
Well, technically, we're doing fine today.
Yeah, I feel pretty good. You know, the typical spring May day in Chicago, just barely going to creep into the 50s, cloudy. But, you know, we kind of, you know, we don't have much of a spring here. We just go from winter to summer, and that's what's happening.
Sure. So, yeah, I think we're doing the same sort of thing. We've got almost identical weather to you, except, of course, it's warmer, but same skies, same rain, same. It's been rainy here for days, so we'll see.
Yeah,
Not too bad, though.
Yeah, yesterday I gave some thought before the day of maybe going to the ballpark, but it was a no-brainer. Rain delays, cold. You could just see people bundled up. A lot of the ball players having their ski mask on and whatever. So it was an easy call. Stay home, watch it with watch that. And St. Louis actually had a rain delay too. So Midwest is pretty well covered with a lot of precipitation.
Yeah. All the way down here too, to Texas. So, anyways, weather's the weather. What do we got today? We got film. We got fake news. We've got sports, and you've got, I think, a follow up.
Oh yes, we've been talking about Brockmeyer, the sports show that's been on IFC with Hank Azaria, and just wanted to comment that now that the show is concluded, I just noticed going through and doing a search that you can continue watching some of the repeats this week, and I'm sure it'll continue on. And Hank had an opportunity to go on CBS Sports and also on MLB Network outside the ballpark. And I think it just supported our feelings that that Hank has about this show.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Hank is that Hank is you know, he's well off doing the Simpsons, etc. But this is his baby. This is the indie thing that allows him to combine his avocation, which is baseball. He's a big Mets fan, and then also his vocation, which is obviously the entertainment business. In this case, the TV show Brockmeyer. So
he's really into it.
Yeah, it's his baby, as he describes it, and it's something which he's kind of wanted to do. As we talked about before, it's not something that all of a sudden came up. He's been working on this for years to try to find the right venue or the right platform, etc., upon which he could do it. And I think IFC provides that, and we look forward to next year when he's already signed up to, and there's a commitment to do a new a series again. And so we'll have 8 new episodes next year, and looking forward to those.
Yep.
So I'm just sitting here comfortably ensconced in my very soft-feeling bro T-shirt.
Ooh, got to have a bro T-shirt, and everyone can buy one anytime you want. And just go to shirt.bro.show.
Yes.
Ooh. Cool. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, you get a good sense of bonding as you take a look at the shirt and see that old fist bump.
Oh, the fist bump. Yeah, the Blood Brother fist bump, which is legend now. And plus, I've gotten a lot of comments from people who have bought the shirt, who have gone, and my friend Brooke, she said, I'll give a little shout out to Brooke. She said, wow. She said, I've had a lot of T-shirts, but this fabric is the best. She says, it's soft, it's stretchy, it dries really fast, and all that stuff. If you were camping and you had a Bro Show T-shirt, you could just wash it in the stream real quick, like, hang it up. Hour and a half later, if it wasn't, raining or something, you'd have a dry shirt.
This is a summer T-shirt. This is a little bit thinner, but extremely soft. It's the kind of shirt that in the morning when you put it on, it makes you feel good.
It does. It does.
Yeah,
you and I like to wear mediums, right? We're pretty much the same size. And so and I like them to fit a little snug, not super snug. And, they really give and everything like that. And it's I can't say enough good things about them. I've also bought and created a lot of T-shirts over the years, and this is definitely our best vendor we've ever had. So,
good.
With the T-shirts. Let's dive in. You've got something good here for us.
Yes, we're going to cover, as we always do, sports, film, and fake news. So one of the things, and we'll start with the sports, it's going to be baseball. A specific player, Derek Jeter. The captain, the variety of nicknames for him. But the bottom line is that this last weekend, Derek's number was retired, number 2. That was the last of the single digits that the Yankees have. They're going to probably have to start going alphanumeric sometime in the near future. in terms of uniform numbers, but that's another problem.
What happens? Not hexadecimal.
No, they could go they could creep into three digits numeric, but add some excitement to it, a little variety. But the thing is that when anything with Derek newsworthy, it always seems to bring out a variety of naysayers who like to talk about the fact that Derek is overrated. Yep. This is a highly debated topic. Derek's not the only player that's had to go through this, but he is right now on the hot seat in terms of this topic. And when he retired in 2014, it all came up. His stats then were all, compiled, and everybody takes a look at them and points out some various weaknesses and this and that and whatever. And sure enough, it all resurrected again this last weekend at the time of retirement. And sure enough, it's not going to go away because in 2020, when Derek ends up going to the Hall of Fame, the arguments will continue to with this topic.
We need you to sort this out for us, John.
Well, the thing is that I have a New York anti-bias. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I'm not a Yankee fan. I don't like the Mets. I don't like the Yankees. There's probably maybe three or four teams in the major leagues that I don't hate them. I just don't like them. It's nothing emotional. It's just a little background here and there, whatever, things I just don't like. But I have myself watched Derek Jeter play probably 35, 40 games here in Chicago. So I have some personal observations as to my feeling as to his on-the-field performance. And I'll tell you right now that when I first saw Derek hit, he has this sort of he doesn't have what you call a very smooth, classic swing. He has what I call an inside-out swing, which means that he's a right-handed hitter who has a tendency to kind of push the ball to the as he swings through, which is kind of conducive to right field, which is a short field in Yankee Stadium. So he plays it very well. So, but the problem with that doggone swing, when I first watched him play back in the mid-90s, is it would generate such feeble-looking balls. He didn't seem to be able to really barrel up. In other words, get solid wood on the ball. His balls, to me, just seem like a quail, kind of fluttering out to the outfield looking for a comfortable place to land on grass.
He's a grass man.
He's a grass man, because I'll tell you right now, I personally felt when I saw him, this is a man who is extremely lucky, because his balls just seem to find grass before hitting a fielder's glove.
Wow.
But after watching this for 4 or 5 years, luck. Yeah. It looked like luck to me.
Yeah.
But you know what?
At first.
If you do this over a period of time, like 20 years, you begin to realize that this is not luck, but this is sort of a skill he has. He has the ability with his batting style to just to hit balls and, hit them where they ain't might be an overstatement, but it sure seems to fit him. Now, that doesn't mean that Derek hit 260 home runs in his career.
Well,
so, I mean, that over 20 years, that's 13 homers per year. So that doesn't mean that Derek didn't have some balls that he really solidly connected on. But it just seemed like so many of his hits fit that category.
It sounds like he's kind of like punching the ball out there.
Yeah, it is. It's a swing that actually, what's good about that kind of swing is that if you're kind of holding up and waiting on the ball and pushing it there to right field, and you're doing it with the idea of a fastball, then what's going to happen is if you do get that curve, you're not going to overreact, and you're going to be able to then, swing a little bit further through and hit the ball to left field rather than, maybe hitting it foul. So
gotcha.
It serves it basically when you have to obviously, be able to adapt to different changes in speed of the pitch.
Sure.
His style fits that very well. So the other thing is that, so that's a little bit on his batting. But, let's face it, we'll talk a little bit about his stats later. He's done very well by himself in terms of that approach. Derek was never considered a great defensive shortstop, and primarily due to lack of range. But, you know, the thing to remember is that when he came up in the mid-90s, you have Cal Ripken, who's sort of toward the end of his career, who's a large shortstop. Derek is like 6'2 or 6'3. So you basically, when you talk about shortstops, there are, you can approach that position a variety of ways. You can approach it where you have a smaller player who's great defensively with a lot of range, good arm.
Pee Wee Reese, was he one of them?
Reese would probably fit more into that category. The classic one would be like Ozzie Smith, who we know very well from St. Louis.
Right.
He would be another good example, Louis Aparicio. There's a bunch of Hall of Fame, a fair number of them, and Ozzie's probably leading the parade of those short shortstops. Then we have the larger ones, such as Cal Ripken, Alex Rodriguez, and Nomar Garciaspia, which all are playing, particularly A-Rod and Nomar, are playing around the same time as Derek. And those two, A-Rod and Nomar, were more offensive. So you take a look at Derek and you say, well, Derek, he's about the same size. But he was nowhere near the hitter that these other two, Alex Rodriguez and Nomar Garciaspia. A-Rod, we'll talk a little bit more about. Nomar's career was kind of a short career. He suffered a lot of injuries. But during his short span in the majors, he was considered a very, very good hitter and also shortstop. Which gets us now to talking a little bit about what is out there in terms of being overrated, and probably the person who has gotten on the bandwagon so much and who is a Yankee fan, by the way, is Keith Olbermann. Now, you know, Keith, his credentials are pretty good. He is considered a baseball expert. He's a member of Society for American Baseball Research. He's a Yankee fan. But anybody who hurts Keith, he knows he's over the edge commentator. What can we say?
He goes overboard.
Overboard. That's a good word for it. This man has a way of taking what would be a nice, rational, solid argument and all of a sudden has to sensationalize it by saying some comments, which sure enough are going to get out. And he's done this. This is his style. I've always, and I enjoy it. I mean, it's fun to watch. You can get a little tired of it. It can get a bit much, but overall it's really good. In fact,
a little goes a long way, right?
Yeah, without a doubt for this guy.
Same with his politics.
Politics, and he's bounced back and forth between sports and politics, although in recent years he's been more on the non-sports bandwagon in terms of his thing. But but every once in a while he just can't resist a temptation and he jumps in. And he'll find something controversial. There's a ball player, a Negro League ball player called Buck O'Neill, who was really big in the Ken Burns baseball series. It just was incredibly good. He made a name for himself. Keith is on the bandwagon to get Buck in the hall.
You're right.
So sure enough, he calls Sabre experts and has them on the show, and I had an opportunity to actually talk to the executive director of Sabre, who Keith interviewed, and he gave me an insight into how Keith likes to work with when he interviews somebody. Keith called this guy beforehand and says, look, we're going to do this interview. That's going to be on Buck O'Neill, this or that. He started asking the fella all these questions. And so the mindset of my friend John Zach, who was being interviewed, was, well, he's just giving me a dress rehearsal on what's going to go on. He never asked him any of those questions. He had a whole other set.
Why did he ask those questions?
What's that?
Why did he ask those questions then?
Well, I mean, it was he just said that it was a setup. It was a setup to just to kind of, you know, get him a little off guard, this and that, and it worked.
Ooh.
Pretty nasty, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm not making Keith out to be a bad guy. It's just that
that's his MO.
So yeah, I mean, he just likes to work a little different angle and whatever he feels he can do to get a bit of an edge. But Keith is when it comes to his baseball knowledge, is right up there with the best of them, and so I do respect his comments and his opinions. His argument against Jeter is a baseball icon.
Yeah.
He says, you know, I mean, he's probably he doesn't even pass what's called the Mount Rushmore test for the Yankees, which means that if you were going to have to place the faces of the four best Yankee players on Mount Rushmore, rather than those presidents they got on them, the bottom line is Derek wouldn't make that. He wouldn't make that cut.
No, no.
He would basically be up in North Dakota or someplace else. Who knows?
Wow.
Bottom line is, we got Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Joe DiMaggio, and Mickey Mantle are probably the top four without much question.
Yeah, so, it sounds like sedition, John. I don't think we can put them on the Mount Rushmore. I hate to tell you that.
Oh, really?
That's not doable? That would be seditious. That would be seditious, yeah.
Ooh, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, back off that call. One.
The Mount Rushmore test is something which came up with is a more of an NBA thing with respect to whether LeBron would get on the. So I think Keith has basically decided to kind of take that analogy and work it with the Yankees. Okay. So the bottom line is that if you took a look at on Keith, he took an extreme. He says, I don't think he's even a top 10 Yankee.
Ooh,
that hurts.
That's smart.
It does. But I would personally, I feel that probably if you looked at him, that we would have Derek be six or probably five or six.
That's not bad.
Contemporary. Yeah. That's where I would put him. He would probably be neck and neck with a top flight relief pitcher called Manuel Rivera or Mo Rivera, who actually spanned Derek's career. I mean, they were the two guys, the mainstays over the 20 years. So we'll talk a little bit about that later. So, yeah, Keith, ragged on him. And believe me, I'll talk about some of the Sabre people who get involved in this. And they, of course, are looking at raw stats. So what are the strengths that we have here that I think are just, that should be noted? And those strengths lie both on the field and also off the field. We have a ball player who has longevity and very good consistency. 20 years in the majors, played 2,747 games, which ranks him 20th all time. There's several players such as Musial and Rose and Cobb that go over 3,000. Derek approached it. He's 2,747. He had 3,495 hits. It ranks him six. Of course, Rose and Cobb both had over 4,000.
Right.
One of the things that kind of can make a player, stand out is if he has played his whole career with one team. The Musial, the Ripken, those type of players. He played for one team. In addition to the fact, during his 20 years, they were also very good. So he played on a winning team. He was also a leader on that team, as demonstrated by the fact that towards the second half, or about since 2003 through 2014, he was a team captain. Now, to be a team captain, Yankee, you'd say, well, there's always a team captain. I can't give you the succession thing, but since the 1920s, there's been like 13 of those captains. And quite often, they don't feel that there's a player that's worthy of being the captain. So there are periods of time when the Yankees don't even have a captain assigned. Derek was an obvious choice to be that. He has a lot of achievements in terms of awards. He's been in 14 All-Star games, 5 Gold Gloves. Gold Gloves is a indication you're the best fielder in his position. And here we're talking about a player who has been basically maligned for the fact that he isn't that good a fielder. And he has 5 Silver Slugger awards, which means that's the best hitter in your position. So he has had his moments when he has, stood out in terms of his contemporaries. Another thing that people often look at when they try to talk about a great player is postseason appearance and performance. You've got some players who are, like Dave Winfield that Steinbrenner said was Mr. September. That means that he couldn't play good in October and on. In other words, guys who just don't seem to be there for the moment, the dramatic moments of postseason. Derek has 16 postseason seasons in which he was in postseason, of which 7 of those he was in the World Series, and 5 of those 7 he was a World Series winner. So he's played on 5 World Series winners in his 20 seasons and been in postseason 16 out of 20. And what really kind of set him off at the beginning to be considered a great player was in his first 6 full seasons in the major leagues, he was in actually 6 full seasons. He had 4 World Series winners, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So a little bit more a flair for the dramatic. Derek seems to find his way into some extraordinary individual plays, games, etc. There was a game in 2000 in which 1996, a postseason game that Derek played against the Baltimore Orioles, which he tied up the score when a ball was hit, a very controversial home run in which a fan by the name of Jeffrey Mayer reached over and caught the ball and brought it back into the stands. And there was a lot of controversy as to whether there was fan interference and that ball should have been a ground rule double. It wasn't. But Jeffrey Mayer is a kind of a, if you say that word up in New York, everybody knows who you're talking about. Just a kid, about 15 or 16 years old. He did this crazy play in the 2001 postseason against Oakland where Derek's playing shortstop and a ball goes out to right field and there's this runner going to score from second base and it's a single. So Derek is nowhere near this play. But what happens is that the outfielder throws the ball too short, and Derek realizes that the ball is not going to get to the home plate so that they can tag out the runner. He goes over, races over to the first baseline. He basically gets the ball as it is rolling and shovels it, or just basically does an underhand throw to the catcher, and they get the guy out. Wow. Now, nobody's ever seen this play done before. And, of course, Derek, in his kind of nonchalant way in his interview, says, oh, we practiced that in spring training. And I think he said that in joke. But it was basically – it just shows that his intuitiveness as he plays the game and his ability to think on his feet was pretty good. He hit a walk-off homer in Game 4 of the 2001 World Series. Now, the 2001 World Series was pushed back. In terms of when it started because of 9/11, there's about a 7-day period where they didn't play ball, so they just pushed everything forward. So as a result of that, this was this game in which Derek hit the home run was played just barely creeped into the new month of November because the series had gotten started. So as a result of hitting a walk-off homer in this game, he got the nickname Mr. November, which is kind of a takeoff on Reggie Jackson's Mr. October. He just finds a way to get involved in these things. Of course, he gets his 3,000 hit. It's a homer. That's only happened once before. He finishes his career on a walk-off hit. So in other words, he basically himself touches home plate, and the game's over and his career's over altogether.
Nice.
So, yeah, I mean, this is stuff. What's not to like? I mean, you couldn't write a movie script with all this stuff in it.
Plus, he's squeaky clean, no steroids, all that good stuff.
Yeah. So you got a guy who's got a clean cup image. He's a good looking guy from Midwest,
Kalamazoo,
Michigan. Yes, and his parents. I can't remember their backgrounds, but it's. They're middle class, good jobs, and the fact is, and I think he has a sister, so he's not an only child.
I thought they were Ward and June Cleaver. Is that right, or did I have that wrong?
Oh yes, that probably would be pretty close. I think we're talking a guy. Well, you know what's interesting about it is though, you're saying, well, Derek always wanted to be a Yankee, and people don't realize that what he would do is he'd spend his summers with his grandparents who lived in New Jersey. Quite often, a fair amount of time. So as a result, he had an affinity towards the New York Yankees, which is
connection.
That is the connection with the Yankees.
Gotcha.
And it seemed like Derek was always considered the most eligible bachelor during his career, constantly dating beauty queens, movie stars. Some of them are nice looking lady athletes. So very marketable. And I think one thing that he did for the Yankees, he saved the day because, you see, the Yankees ended up in 2004 getting Alex Rodriguez. And Alex, they paid a lot of money for. He was making $25 million a year. And the Yankees were taking on probably a good 6 or 7 years of that contract. And so their idea was, well, we'll market A-Rod. Well, marketing A-Rod's like a disaster in addition to all his steroid stuff. He has a way of getting his name in the paper for all the wrong reasons. You know, his idea of dating was to sneak around with people like Madonna and, you know, bounce all over the place. Who knows what? And by the way, he was married. So that didn't help matters much while he's doing all these shenanigans. So Derek's there to save the day. he's the one who can then be the face of the Yankees and save A-Rod.
So what's the thing against him? What do people not like about
him? It's like these Saber guys that they latch on to these Saber metrics, Saber metric statistics. They're numbers guys, and I mean, I went on the listserv. As a Saber member myself, I am constantly getting a dialogue through a listserv, and Derek was for a good week or the last 4 or 5 days was you knew it was just a matter of time before somebody was going to come on and point out some of the stats. And one of them is I don't even want to describe in detail this stat, but it's one that is called WAR, wins against replacement. And it's anytime I see the word assumption, and I see a lot of assumptions being made, it turns me off when it comes to it. Give me the raw information. I'm an accountant. I can digest it. Thank you. So wins against replacement is some sort of way in which you try to say that if we had to replace this player in his in a game or something, then here's how much better he is than his than the norm. Derek, when you take a look at this statistic, lifetime, his career, ranks 88th. So he's not exactly what you call, what we would call one of these top echelon Hall of Famers. I've already pointed out the fact that he probably ranks 5th or 6th in terms of the Yankees. BaseballReference.com, which is the website which basically took the paper book encyclopedia and put it out of business because it is so good in terms of encyclopedic type information, has a calculation which what they try to do is do similar batters to a certain player. It's at the end of the entry. Mm-hmm. As you take a look at Derek, he's batting wise, he's compared to guys who are kind of what I would call middle of the road at best, Hall of Famers like Craig Biggio, who is like these are not household names. Roberto Alomar. So probably the bottom line is that they don't look at the whole picture; they're just looking at the batting. Of course, you'd say, well, gee, if they put the whole picture together, he'd probably be worse than that because he's not a very good fielder. But the bottom line is he's probably a better comparison to somebody like Cal Ripken. So that's another thing. Now, you can also go to the Baseball Reference shortstop ranking, and he's ranked 12th, of which there are three guys, non-Hall of Famers, above him. So that's another thing that they say. Here's the one that people really love to do when they talk about defensive weakness. They like to point out the fact that when A-Rod came over, Alex Rodriguez, to the Yankees in 2004, that at that point, A-Rod had not won any gold gloves, and that Derek had not won
Derek,
any.
Right.
And what happened was Alex Rodriguez ended up playing third base for the Yankees, and sure enough, as soon as A-Rod is not a shortstop anymore, Derek starts winning them. Now, gold glove is a very – is you can't help but think about the whole player when you vote for these people, the sports writers vote for the gold glove. So it has its own controversy in itself.
Yeah.
So the conclusion was that that as I take a look at all this, I like to think in terms of the fact that we've got a player here who has extremely good stats assuring his Hall of Fame admission. But what you've got to do is you've got to take a look at some of these other non-statistical stats that will then probably, image, playing on a winning team, the leadership, the dramatic individual performance, make a compelling case for me, for him to be considered a baseball icon and being amongst the high end of those Hall of Famers. And what I like to just kind of finish it up is I think what we have here is we have synergy.
Right.
You put things together here and you put a very, very good resume on the field with a very, very good resume off the field, and you've got more than that. And that's what I think makes Derek what he is. And the idea of trying to compare him to somebody else, I think, is not the way to approach. Because he's got a unique, singular presence in the game.
Jet is more than the sum of his parts.
Exactly. That's the way I take a look at it. It's fun to go through and to read some of the things. But the bottom line is, I think he's very deserving of the accolades that have been placed upon him. And like I said before, go ahead.
I think we have to point out here that we talked about Obermann and his rant. If anyone's going to go look for that rant, you're not going to be able to play it in the United States.
Oh,
there's some problem with the rights to that audio file or video file, and you can't do it. If you're my daughter, who's in Holland, was able to play it. We're not able to play it. So if you're looking for it and want to hear it, you're not going to do that. But there's some articles that have large, almost a transcript of it. So.
Yeah, the Sports Illustrated. There's a Sports Illustrated article. So if you put Keith Olbermann and Derek Jeter, Sports Illustrated, you'll come up with an article where the writer for Sports Illustrated does a pretty good job of summarizing and giving a fair amount of detail too on the Keith Olbermann rant.
Right.
But I'll
right.
tell you, I think the thing that we want to emphasize here about that rant is that rant was done 2 years ago, and it was resurrected again 2 years later. With
right.
respect to Derek, so it's kind of an it shows you the extreme that people go to, the extreme side of bashing the Derek Jeter bashing.
Yeah, so. Someday, so maybe in a future episode, there's a whole thing there, a sports episode on Obermann, which is I think an interesting topic in and of itself.
Oh,
right?
Oh yes, Keith. Yeah, he's a
That's
very
a segment
interesting
that
guy.
That bleeds into fake news too.
No, but okay. But Keith has a way of getting involved in some baseball history. He's really into a what's considered one of the most unique things that happened in baseball, called the Merkle error that was done in 1908. So he's hung up on certain things that he loves to talk about. So you're right. We could do something very good on Keith.
Cool.
So
let's talk about
section.
Sinatra. Let's talk about film and Sinatra.
Oh,
and everything
I'll tell
Sinatra.
You.
Let's talk Sinatra.
Sinatra, yes. Frank Sinatra, Francis Albert Sinatra. Fact is that I would say, just on a personal perspective, our family, Jerry, I, and my brother in particular, Jeff, our younger brother, have always kind of had, particularly Sinatra as he got older, we would look forward to, reading about him. My brother and I probably together, Jeffrey, my younger brother, went to at least 10 of his concerts. And so my brother took it to an extreme, though.
Well, brother, he's a Daniels.
Yeah, I would say that as much as my passion is baseball, my brother Jeff's passion has been Frank Sinatra, to the extreme that he got into the restaurant business and actually had a Frank Sinatra-themed restaurant called The Summit.
Yep.
That was in St. Louis now.
Yep.
We've both been there.
Yeah,
it was this restaurant.
Cool.
It was very neat. It was a 90s thing. He probably had it between 1990 and 2001 or 2002.
Right.
So he had it for a very long time. This was not a flash in the pan. So 7-8 years is considered the average life of a restaurant.
And it's a tough business.
My brother's restaurant. It's a tough business, no doubt. And so the Summit is what he called it. And the reason he called it the Summit was because that is what the Rat Pack, as they were known back in the early 60s, his entourage that included, Dean Martin, Peter Lawford, Sammy Davis Jr., they made a movie, Ocean's 11, in 1960. Yeah. And while they're making the movie at night, they were doing a kind of a cut-up, ad-lib nightclub act at the Sands Hotel. And around the same time, Eisenhower was meeting with Khrushchev, and they called that the Summit. So all of a sudden, they called the nightclub act, this crazy nightclub act, they called it the Summit. So that's where they all convened after
wow.
the a hard day's working in the movies, 8 or 9 o'clock at night. These guys are out there, having fun, ad-libbing, singing a few songs, joking around. And so that's where the Summit came, and that's what my brother called his restaurant. Now, if you took a look at his restaurant, it was like a Frank Sinatra museum.
Yeah.
My brother's restaurant, the Summit. He had a what would you describe, Jerry? That what he had on the back of the bar that
that large, a mural,
almost. Yes,
huge painting.
And it had all the players that sitting there, and Dean kind of on the side, kind of you just like Dean Martin. He would always be more of an observer, and it just really you could stare at that and analyze that picture forever as you're sitting at the bar. He had, in addition to a lot of pictures, he also had a lot of reviews. When Frank came out of retirement, he had about a 2-year stint back in the early 70s where he decided to retire. But when he made his comeback, he did a lot of touring, and my brother had all these reviews. So you could go around and spend 3 or 4 hours just reading the reviews that he had, put into, framed. And so it was just a really nice place. So
As you're talking here, a couple of things occurred to me. Number one, I think that a part of Jeff's fascination with our father was we were his second family, so he was an older guy. And he kind of had the sensibilities of a roaring 20s kind of person. And he always had a little bit of a gangster vibe. He had one of them pencil mustaches, and he was short, and he had a little gun he carried around in the car. You know, he was a character. I don't think they make him like that anymore. And I think that a little of that rubs off, and that may have been some of... Yeah, that may have been some of all of our interest in this whole. I think all three of us were interested in things that maybe people in our age bracket weren't normally interested in.
No.
The second thing I find interesting about Sinatra was that two things actually. One is he was really the first singer, and we're going to talk about this in more detail. He was the first singer to really get women to scream, girls in particular, and so that was like before Elvis, before the Beatles. Frank Sinatra was doing that. And then, the other thing is, these days, you can hardly think about Frank Sinatra without also thinking about Johnny Fontaine from The Godfather. So, this all means that, you kind of have to go through this. And John, I think you're going to take us through some of this. You've read books.
A
book. And you're going to unravel a little of this, how much of that legend from The Godfather is real, how much of it isn't. And I think the big thing is he started something different, because here was a singer who came up in radio, in live performance, and television. So he approached singing, I think, his style, he approached it differently. The other singers really were kind of hung up on being singers.
Mm-hmm.
Great voices, great sound, all that stuff. But he was more into style and voice. And later, of course, it was just style, because his voice wasn't as strong. That's true for The Godfather.
The fact is that just getting back to our father's kind of interest, I would say that I would characterize my father as a Damon Runyon type character, something
Ooh, nice.
You would think of. He was always on, kind of like Jerry mentioned, he's on the edge of he probably rub elbows with a few guys who were in the outfit,
mobbed up.
Mobbed up guys. In addition to the fact that the only book I remember my father having was a book called The Greenfelt Jungle, which kind of talked about how the outfit or the mafia or whatever you want to call it got involved in Las Vegas. So he kind of was like Sinatra, was interested in that segment of the population or the profession. And we'll talk a little bit of where Sinatra fits into that too. So, why did all of a sudden I get involved in learning about Sinatra? Well, back in 2010, an author by the name of James Kaplan, who had also written a book about with Jerry Lewis called Dean and Me. He's written a book about John McEnroe. It's a bunch of articles. James Kaplan decided to write a book about Frank Sinatra. Now you're saying, geez, well, just what we need, another book about Sinatra. How many more of these books do we need? But you're going to find quite often you find quite often, this is not the exception, that there are different, subjects that when you think all has been written, somebody comes up and writes something that even gives you more. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about there's a 2-volume set. We're talking here about probably between 1,600 and 1,700 pages on Sinatra. And so that's a lot of a book to read. And I like to talk a little bit about how I approach, trying to decide, well, is it worth it to read 1,600 pages?
That's a lot of pages, John.
That is a lot. And I've read probably, I'll be truthful, I've only read about 300 pages of the book. But this book is, books are very worthwhile to read. And I can tell you that my approach to it is the typical thing where what you do is you look at the reviews. You take a look. Does it have good footnotes? Is it well, you know, has it been researched well? But the thing that I like to look at that quite often people don't is acknowledgments.
Right.
And James Kaplan does a very good job of acknowledging his editor. You can see that he's had actually authors of other Sinatra books read his book, his you know, reviews. His you know, early versions of it before it's out. So he gets a lot of collaboration, gets a lot of feedback, which he finds very instrumental. And I find that when you work under that collaborative type of environment, you're going to end up with a much better product. And he seems to, and he has done that. The other thing is that his book reads more like a novel. He does have some experience in writing novels. So you feel as you're reading it that you're there. You're part of the story.
Right, right.
And that is very important. So I'm going to give just a couple of examples here. And first thing that since I've the two volumes by James Kaplan, one came out in 2010, the other one came out in 2015. The first one is called The Voice. The second one is called The Chairman. Now, the books themselves are more chronological. So one book goes through his making of the movie From Here to Eternity, which is like 53 or 54. So it stops there. The next book, this continues on chronologically from 54 on to the rest of his life. So that's the way it's sort of set up, even though you kind of read the titles and think one's maybe more music and one's maybe non-music, but it kind of does it chronologically. So a couple of the things that come out at the beginning of the book, I think, are part, and Jerry, you've kind of already alluded to this, and that is that Sinatra, when he started singing, didn't have the greatest voice. The competition he ran into when he, Sinatra's born in 1915, he really gets into singing, you know, early in his late teens. His competition is Bing Crosby.
Right.
Now, Bing Crosby is known, he's a baritone, effortless.
It's that was just, his thing.
He made it look easy. You think, Bing, don't fall asleep while you're singing. He was just at ease with
like
himself.
Like Perry Como, kind of.
Yeah, Perry Como is another good example of that. So Frank, what he did is he didn't have quite the voice, but he had a way of expressing it so that you were, the words meant as much to him as the sound of his voice. So he put feelings into it. It's like he's talking a song, singing and talking, but he isn't talking, but you basically feel like he's telling a story.
Yes,
with a lot of emotion.
You feel like he's talking to you.
Yes. There's a lot of that where you and that was very important. He had some influences early in his career. He started with a small group. And by the way, his mother was an incredible influence. She was one of the I wouldn't call her a stage mom as in a typical sense, but she did help him in terms of his career by getting him jobs in nightclubs, small nightclubs, etc., in the Hoboken,
in the
Jersey area. And that was very helpful to him to make sure that his career pushed along. Frank was an only child, and I would characterize him as being treated pretty special. I wouldn't call him spoiled, but let's just say that Frank, the number of days that Frank actually did 9 to 5, we could probably less than 10.
Wow.
He tried a few things here and there, but he was meant to be an entertainer, and he was driven to be that. So he aspired to be the, you know, a singer. And the fact is that he started with the Harry James Band. And then what he did is he moved on and went to the Tommy Dorsey Band, which was the lead singer of that band, which was considered one of the best dance bands in the late 30s through the 40s.
Yep.
But Frank always had higher aspirations. And I think one of the myths that can't come out of this is the fact that Frank realized that he wanted to become a singer. He didn't want to be a dance band singer. He didn't want to be part of a group. He wanted to stand out alone. He wanted to be able to go out on that stage alone and sing with the band as the background, or right. some sort of musical accompaniment.
Right.
So he wanted to get out of he signed a contract with Dorsey that basically gave Tommy Dorsey a percentage of his earnings for the rest of Frank's life.
Yeah.
That's scary stuff.
It was probably unenforceable, realistically speaking.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. But and Frank, I think, signs all this with the idea that he just kind of said, well, I'm not going to live up to this anyway, so I'll just sign it. And there has been some myths as to how he was able to get out of that, and that the basically the gangster portion. And Frank, at that point in his life, was more in awe of gangsters, not very kind of – he wasn't rubbing elbows with them at this point.
He wasn't that connected.
The connection – here's probably the earliest connection. If he did – his godfather was Willie Moretti. Was a kind of a middle of the road gangster, but Frank didn't have a lot of connection with him. But a lot of people try to tie him in his early, that he was very early involved with gangsters. When the case is that it was something after World War II is when this really
right.
became more prominent, and
right.
he went to Hollywood. So bottom line is that he's got this contract and he's not paying, and Dorsey's upset. And the way it is all taken care of is not with gangsters, but in fact with his talent, his agent, and also the music union got together and basically paid Dorsey. They came up with an agreement, and what the music union says, Tommy, would you like to continue having your band on radio at night? And he said, of course I would. And he says, well, we're going to try to make sure that happens after we settle this contract. So it put a little
nice.
Pressure on him that way, but
nice.
Clearly there's no really direct mob connection, even though if you took a look at the movie The Godfather, you would kind of, that's what it's made up of these, one of the incidents. The other incident that you hear about in terms of Sinatra getting help from the mob was when he got the part in From Here to Eternity.
Yeah.
Now, Columbia
also
Pictures.
Also in The Godfather.
Now, also in The Godfather with the horse and the whole bit, or part of a horse. but the thing was that when Sinatra, this is a very low point in his career where he was having trouble with respect a little bit with his voice. His songs weren't selling that well. He was having to resort to go to nightclubs that weren't always filled up. And his movie career had kind of stumbled a little bit after making some great pictures with MGM. And so here we are in the early 50s. He's also run into problems outside, with Ava Gardner. He's having an affair. And poor Nancy's at home with the kids.
Right.
So his image is going right down the tubes. And so he gets an opportunity to be in this movie called From Here to Eternity, a novel, best-selling novel by James, James Jones, I think is his name. The fact is that there was a part in there, an Italian.
Perfect.
Called that it's just made for him. So the rumors are that Sinatra goes to the head of the Columbia Pictures, a guy named Harry Cohn, and pleads with him. And you leave the impression that Cohn doesn't like Sinatra. Well, it's just
right.
the opposite. He thinks Sinatra's great. In addition to the fact that if there's any mob connection at this point, Harry Cohn was buddy with Bugsy Siegel.
Bugsy Siegel, yeah.
Yeah, so as a result, if there's a gangster edge to either of these two, Sinatra versus the president of Columbia Pictures, it's with Harry Cohn.
Right.
So what happens, in effect, is that Sinatra does a screen test. They love it. But there's another well-known actor by the name of Eli Wallach, who was more of a character actor, very good actor, who does it. And there's a screen test, and they're both very, very good. So
ironically, Eli Wallach shows up in Godfather 3.
Yo, thank you. I was not aware of that. That's a good
ironically,
point.
Ironically. It plays a great part, by the way. Anyway, continue.
So what happens is that Cohn is he says both these guys are good. He looks at his wife and says, why don't you look at these screen tests? And she says, look, Frank might not have all the acting chops that Eli Wallach does, but man, when it comes to his appearance on screen, he's your man. So if anybody's pushing, it was Harry Cohn's wife who made the final call. This has nothing to do with gangsters. So
I had no idea.
That's another. Yeah. So the fact is that the whole thing with Sinatra, you know, there's, you know, the Rat Pack, for example, is, you know, this book has a way of it does a great job of also using primary sources and also, when it does use secondary sources, citing them within the context of it rather than in the notes. The notes are nice because notes, footnotes quite often just they'll give sources, but what these footnotes, some of them do, is they give additional information, which is always nice when you can get those little extra tidbits that don't quite fit into the novel but are, you know, little trivia and stuff like that. It's really good. The Rat Pack is another thing that you've heard that term used, and it's a term that was used to describe that collection of his buddies that did the movie Ocean's 11 back in 1960. But the term itself, Frank, was there's actually two Rat Packs. There was an earlier Rat Pack.
What was that?
And that was Sinatra. It was actually one that was brought together by Humphrey Bogart. Bogie was a guy who liked to have fun in Hollywood. And so what they did is that him and Lauren Bacall would, you know, go out and they would, you know, do the bar scene. But Bogie used to like to mostly drink at home. So they'd bring their entourage back and included Sinatra as part of this. This is back in the mid-50s. This is like five years before the Vegas thing. And they're all drinking, and it's about 6 o'clock in the morning. And Lauren Bacall says, "Oh boy, this place looks like a Rat Pack," because they were all kind of just laying around and kind of, you know, loose, easy. So she came up with the term Rat Pack. Sinatra was part of it, and then what he did is he basically coined his group later on with the same name. That's another interesting story because, you see, Frank Sinatra and Lauren Bacall were a real item after Bogie passed away in 1957. Wow. But unfortunately, Lauren Bacall made a big mistake and publicized their relationship and kind of publicized it in a way that it was a little bit further along than Frank thought it was. And all of a sudden, he just dropped her like a hot potato.
Ooh.
So, yeah, but there's a lot of that in these books.
Historically, there's some more recent Rat Pack. The St. Elmo's Fire movie had a group of young actors, Emilio Estevez and Molly Ringwald and a bunch of them, and they got called the Rat Pack also.
Yes. They did the Breakfast. There was a Breakfast Club, some of those Hughes movies that were filmed here in Chicago was an area where some of those same.
Yep.
They just seemed to kind of, they worked well together and they played well together. That's what it takes to be a Rat Pack.
I guess so. We got one more topic, John.
So that's that. I do recommend these two books. I'll just say again, James Kaplan. You get them in paperback. And I mean, it's a page turner all the way. That's all I can say. So we got more stuff to go here.
Yeah, we do. We're going to talk a little about the fake news. And, of course, it's hard to talk about the fake news without talking about this week's events. We had some other things in mind that we wanted to talk about. But I think we have our own take on what's going on, as the Daniels brothers will have. And so what we have here is we have the special counselor who is now going to take over the FBI investigation of possible wrongdoings, charges of obstruction of justice that are being thrown President Trump's way, also the Russia connections and all that stuff. So it's expanded a bit. And so the real eye-opening thing here is the cast of characters. What happened, most people know by now, they have the Justice Department has said, we're naming a special counselor, and, you know, they used to call him a special prosecutor, and this has a long history that I don't think we have time to get into, but it goes back and forth between stronger and weaker in different directions depending upon who they're aiming the barrel of their gun at. But this most recent incarnation really gives the Justice Department, the DOJ, and to an extent indirectly the president, more control over this select person. So, what happened? Well, Jeff Sessions had to recuse himself from all this stuff because it came out that he had falsified some testimony before the House or the Senate. And had to admit, yeah, he was involved in some talking to Russians. Therefore, he had to recuse himself of all matters regarding this. So his deputy, and I think that's Rod, what's his last name?
Rosenstein.
That's it.
Rod Rosenstein. So, what's interesting about this is that you have to understand.
Guy.
Yes, Jeff Sessions is appointed. He's a guy that's basically, he's a Trump guy.
Right.
Rod Rosenstein is a career prosecutor. He's a career guy within the Department of Justice. He's
right.
The assistant right underneath him. So we have a player here who probably, and Jerry, you can go into this a little bit more, but is as independent as you're going to find.
Well, that's interesting because here's the interesting thing about it. Number one, everybody thought that. When he came up and he had to get okayed by the Senate, he got 94 out of 100 and of the senators to back him. So only six people said no. So
oh,
that
you're talking about Sessions, are you? Are you
no.
You're talking about, oh, so it's Rosenthal?
I'm talking about Rosenstein. Yeah,
okay,
Rosenstein.
Okay, good. Okay,
yeah,
Rosenstein.
So he got a lot of support and from a lot of Democrats, too. So
Yes. Everybody
had high hopes, and they were really thinking, well, this will be good. This will balance out Sessions. So people were feeling pretty good about him. And then the poor guy, he ends up putting together a letter that was a justification for Comey getting fired,
right.
Stating that Comey had performed badly as regards the Hillary Clinton email stuff. And many people would agree that that was the case. But this was used as cover for the fact, admitted by Trump himself, that Trump just didn't want this Russia thing going any further forward. So he figured best way to solve that problem is get rid of the guy who's doing it. And he asked Rod to write this letter, and he used him. He kind of played him a little bit.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were very disappointed and very unhappy that this happened. And so Comey was out. And so people were having a lot of dark thoughts. A lot of Democrats having a lot of dark thoughts about Mr. Rod. So what happens now is gets real interesting. Everyone had pretty much gone, okay, nothing's going to happen. We're going to plunk along with these committees inside of the House and the Senate, and there are four of them. And then also the FBI is going to do what it can, but it sounds like they're getting hobbled. So all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the deputy of the DOJ says, nope, special counselor. And here he is. And who'd they pick? They picked Robert Mueller. So, Robert Mueller has a much better reputation even than Rod, well, I can't remember his last name.
Rosenstein.
Yeah. So, even better, you know. And so, and he's like a dog with a bone. This guy's famous. I mean, super famous for never letting go, getting all the detail. So this guy, I mean, he's going to be forced in and of himself, and he's going to ask for stuff. You know, he's already got his own chief of staff came over with him from the other from his law practice. He's really coming in with barrels blazing, and so this is really bad news for Donald Trump. And I don't think Donald Trump's going to be able to do anything about this. And if he does somehow get Rosenstein to fire Mueller, then it's Armageddon. Then we're going to have some real problems in the government and some real protests. Anything we've seen so far has been kid stuff. So I don't think that's going to happen. But the interesting thing about Rosenstein is, just yesterday, the New York Times got a guy on tape, a friend of Comey's, not like the closest, but pretty damn close. They have lunch at least once a month, and they run in some of the same security/legal circles, and he sat down with him and kind of poured his heart out to him and told him what the real story was behind all this stuff with Trump and everything, and you know, much of what we heard about Trump, this guy put on the record. He said, this is not a leak. This is an interview. I'm on the record. I'm never going to work for the government, so I don't care what they want to do to me. Here it is. And he laid it out, and he said, put your tape recorder on. Let's do it. And I heard some of the tape. John, you've heard some of the tape. It's
right.
Incredibly clear, unambiguous. Comey's dilemma with Trump. He felt terrible that many people thought he got him elected. He really hated how Trump was continually trying to ensnare him, continually asking him for his loyalty, Wittes, or whatever his name is, the guy who, his friend, who put himself on tape said.
Lawyer.
How many times do you have to be asked to kiss the ring before you actually end up kissing the ring? And that is what Comey said he believes Rosenstein has done. He said about Rosenstein in talking to Wittes, and this was, you know, early on, even before Rosenstein did the letter. He said, well, the thing about Rod is Rod's a good guy, and he's got the chops, but he's a career guy, and he's been doing this for quite a while, and he has made compromises. And he said, I fear he will make some with Trump. And it turns out he was right. But
he was Rosenstein's resurrecting himself. I think he's overcome that.
He's resurrecting himself.
Yeah.
And I don't believe, as some people say, that this is cover for Trump. I don't think Rosenstein is going to cover for Trump. I think he now sees the error of his ways, and he sees, okay. And he really has tilted the balance of power in this whole thing, which is all fake news, of course, about Trump denying any involvement. Oh, I didn't ask Comey to do that. Comey told me 3 times that I was not under investigation. All that's nonsense. It's bullshit. But the real deal is starting to come out.
Comey was sweating bullets anytime he got close to Trump because he thought he'd get the good old bear hug that Trump likes to do. And that would even make it look worse. On camera. So he's just going nuts. Thinking, oh, I'm going to hide myself in the White House when he invited me there with a bunch of other people. Well, that's kind of a joke in itself because, Jerry, how big is Comey?
Six foot eight.
Yeah, you're hardly going to, you know, hide yourself in a crowd when you're 6 foot eight. And sure enough, he thought he dodged the bullet. Trump was just, he almost made it. There was a meeting in which Trump was invited Comey to come to. In his office, in the Oval Office, with a bunch of other people, and sure enough,
what's Comey do? Comey's looking for drapes that match his clothes, so he won't be seen. That's the funniest thing I think I've ever heard.
Yeah,
that was a good one.
So as a result, Trump at the last minute sees him, goes over, and as Trump is approaching Comey, Comey's sweating bullets. Like, oh God, how can I get out of this? And what he tried to do is he tried to get a handshake rather than the hug by putting his hand out.
That was his result.
Yeah, that was his. He was trying to do, but the problem was that Trump was more interested in getting closer. And before you know it, the end result is probably even worse than a hug. Because a hug, and it's pretty sad.
It looks like a combination of them. Either he's whispering in Comey's ear, which is, of course, what he wanted to have it look like, or he's kissing him.
Yeah. The kiss,
Oh, man, this is bad.
Yeah, this isn't anyway. France. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. So there's where we stand today.
Why don't you give a little background on Mueller? Because I think we have to understand that this is not a man that just is Johnny come lately. He's got
No.
To talk in terms of his background and his ability to, you know, how long was he? Was he attorney general or what would he have been?
He's director of FBI. Before Comey.
Oh, yeah, and director of FBI, that's what it was.
And also, quick note for people who are listening from Austin, we have a Robert Mueller airport, or we did at one time. It was our main airport. It's now Bergstrom. But, everyone here thinks Mueller is pronounced Mueller. Oddly enough, it's a German name, and that's an anglicization of an umlaut, which would really be pronounced completely different. And Germans who came over with that name, by and large, like to be called Miller. And that is what the guy who the airport was named after called himself. But the airport was only called that for a very short period of time. And it just got called Mueller. But it was never called Mueller. So we all scratch our heads down here when we hear the news. And they keep calling Robert Mueller, Robert Mueller. And we think it should be Robert Mueller. But it's not. But this guy has an unbelievable reputation, and I recommend you listen to The Daily, which is a 20-minute podcast, 5 days a week. Michael Barbaro does it, and he does an extremely good job. And he's got this story in it, but I'll just quickly run through it. It's called the Red Car Story, and evidently this is how people characterize Mueller, his tenaciousness and his just unrelenting nature. And they said the thing is, the red car story is, A guy comes in. He's being debriefed. He's being debriefed by Mueller. He's involved in some kind of investigation, and he reports that this guy took off in a car. And so he's ready now for Mueller to ask what color was the car. And the agent gleefully says it was red, thinking he's out of the woods. No. Mueller now wants to know what shade of red. So that's kind of the way the guy rolls.
What shade of red? You believe it?
He'll keep digging down until really you're in despair. And agents and people in the FBI, he's a legend for this kind of behavior. And, of course, they have polite and impolite ways of talking about it. But as a citizen, I'm pretty happy about that behavior. I think we need a guy like this right now. And I have to tell you, among progressives, Democrats, independents, and I think even a large number of Republicans, people are happy about this.
First thing is that we're talking about a former FBI director who they served 10 years. He
yes.
served with both under a Republican and a Democrat. You got Bush, Obama. In addition
yep.
to the
Obama
fact
kept him
that
on.
Obama kept him on more than the 10 years because
12,
of some,
he
felt the need. He did 12 years altogether. So here we have a fellow who has served under both parties, you know, presidential, and he's also then been asked to extend his service because he's needed, you know, for special because of special circumstances.
Yeah,
so
and largely
I think
because
we,
of his rap,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. So I think we got a guy who's really got a great reputation, and so and I think the other thing to keep in mind is trying to sort out the players here. I mean, this is beyond even having a scorecard to try to sort out what's going on because we've got, you know, we've got each house, the Senate and the representatives using their intelligence committee to also have their own. And, you know, those have been in the news. We don't need to.
Yeah.
These aren't deep, dark secrets.
No.
But we have to understand that it's important to understand exactly what each of these players are involved in.
Yeah. What's their scope? In other words, what is their
purview?
And what can they do?
Exactly. So we have to understand that the special counsel is looking for criminal is pushing, and their scope is criminal activity.
Yes.
So they're looking for something which they can prosecute based upon breaking the law. So their scope is relatively narrow, but the end result could be pretty potent. And it's not something that's going to happen overnight. But the bottom line is that's pretty serious stuff.
That guy reports to the DOJ, and particularly
DOJ.
He now reports to the deputy, not Jeff Sessions. He reports to Rosenstein.
Exactly.
Good news.
Very good news. The other side of this is we've got these two committees on the South House of Representatives and the Senate that they're permanent committees, the Committee on Intelligence.
Yep.
And so they've got other responsibilities other than just investigating, but part of their responsibilities that they can investigate. They are going to be preparing reports that eventually will get to their respective house.
Correct.
Then, so they basically have no power in terms of what
legal,
the end result
yeah.
will be. They're just pushing information up to the Senate or the House of Representatives, and then those two groups will have the opportunity to decide what they're going to do. It could affect, you know, could be new legislation, it could be impeachment, it could be a variety of things could happen out of that. The challenge lies by having both of these, the House of Representatives and the Senate involved, is that somewhere along the line they're going to have to connect and work together. So this
yes.
is a long, drawn-out process with respect to those. Now, their scope is basically the Russian gate. You know, the scope is
yes.
about the same, except that they can also be collecting what's called like incidental information
indirect
yeah. evidence that might push their investigation in a variety of directions. Now, to add even more to it than that, then we have another group, the Oversight Committee in the House of Representatives. Jerry,
correct.
Maybe you can kind of tell what their thing is. Because that's
well,
fairly recent.
They're much broader even than the investigatory council groups, and
yeah.
I think it's hard to say which group? I find this stuff a little murky myself. Maybe you have more specificity, specificity on it, John, but I find it that it's a little murky. But my sense is that the Oversight Committee, I think traditionally they're the ones who will push the I word, the impeachment stuff.
Impeachment, but at this point, they've actually taken on a little a side thing that's happened since then, and they're concerned about the firing of Comey.
Comey, yeah.
That's where that is where their energies are going to be going. So
he's all intermingled, though.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, I was trying to. There's also this issue of subpoena.
Yes.
That which of these groups can do subpoena? Now, if you go and try to work this out, you're going to find sources are going to say, well, there's four committees that can do subpoenas in the House. There's three in the Senate. These are just examples. These aren't the exact. And these are moving targets as to what they can do. So I ended up doing some research and found out that basically all these committees, if they go through a procedural process, can do subpoenas. But some of them have subpoena powers where they don't have to go through a process.
Right.
So the number that can do subpoenas is always going to be a moving target.
Correct.
Based upon how far they push, you know, to get the subpoena power. But one of the challenges lies in the fact that if, for example, we've seen this with Flynn, who, by the way, has not answered the subpoenas that the Senate committee has, the Intelligence Committee has done. So he's still out there trying to bargain, or who knows what's going on.
Yeah, he keeps going. He wants to get immunity, but immunity. No one wants to give it to him.
The fact is that immunity is, and this is part of the challenge, because if the Senate or the House committee ends up giving him immunity, that immunity is going to also flow into the special counsel.
Yeah, it limits. It has a limiting
effect. It has a limiting effect. So
I don't think it's going to happen. No one's given it to him thus far. He asked for it a long time ago and said he had a really great story to tell. But you know, when they don't give you immunity, there's only one reason. That's because the big fish you're going to hand over, they've already got enough.
They've already got enough on the big fish, exactly.
And we all know who the big fish is.
Ooh.
It's Trump.
Yeah.
It's Trump.
Yeah, the guy got out of Dodge just yesterday. Now he's in the Middle East somewhere, I guess.
Yeah.
In Saudi Arabia. He basically blew town when the heat got too hot.
And who knows where Flint is? Flynn? Is it Flynn or Flint?
Here.
Flynn. It's Flynn.
Flynn. Yeah, Flynn. Yeah. Flynn.
Anyway, he might be in Turkey.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Flynn is a guy who just basically, he's in it for the money. So who's ever going to pay him the most is where he's going to land. So who's throwing bucks his direction, that's where you're going to find him. That's my opinion.
The people who know where Flynn is, I would only ask one thing. I think that man needs a Bro Show t-shirt, John.
Oh. Yeah.
Don't you think that would really help him? I think it would. I think he needs a Bro Show t-shirt. So someone get the word to him. The URL is shirt.thebro.show. And
ooh.
He needs one. It's dark blue. It's got some great colors. And as we already pointed out, no t-shirt feels better on your bod than that t-shirt. So you guys go for
comfy.
It.
Comfy.
Mm. Very nice. Well, I think we had a pretty good session here today, John.
Yes. I think we've covered a lot of stuff all over the board. I mean,
We did. So we'll be talking to you tomorrow as per usual.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it. See you, bro.
Bye, bro.
Bye.